Hello everybody and welcome to this week's bonus podcast where we are going to be talking about the retcons and revisions of Coronation Street.
What? I hate it.
Because there's been one this week, haven't
there?
I don't know whether you noticed, but the fans have been a little bit niggled this week about what's going on with Artoya.
Well, now listen.
What?
Now listen. We haven't got to Wednesday's episode.
We haven't, but we're gonna print this. We're gonna publish this after Wednesday's episode.
Okay, right. But we do, as you know. Know a few people on the show, and we haven't specifically asked this, but we do know that there supposedly is possible what happened was possible, could have possibly happened.
We're going to talk a lot more about Toya's retcon on Friday.
You can't say Toya's retcon. We're dancing around.
I don't think this episode's going to be about that. Otherwise, I don't think you'd be able to shut us up about it. And there's lots of internet discourse over there on that subject online if you want to check it out right now.
I absolutely feel no need or great rush to add to the discourse surrounding this storyline because I feel as though everyone's done it already.
I'm sure we will, though, but not now, not now.
Not right now.
This is just to talk about other times that Corrie has gone back on its word somewhat. We've not quite had a Bobby Ewing in the shower moment of, have we? But we know that's our only standard.
Can I just say that this is supposed to be an evergreen content, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we shouldn't have started talking about something specific that's happening this week. We should just be very generic.
Sometimes
we'll just forget all that.
Corrie retcons things.
Let's just start
and let's remind ourselves of it.
Welcome to our episode about Corrie's retcons and revisions. See how I retcon the beginning of that episode?
Nice. Okay, it never happened. Never happened, what we said before. I like it.
What is a retcon, Michael?
Well, I've been doing a little bit of research about this because I think lots of things that people say are retcons aren't actually retcons. I certainly use the word retcon to not mean the exact
definition of the word,
but it stands for retroactive continuity. So it's something that comes from comic books, apparently. And it's when you go back and you change the history of usually a work of fiction to accommodate the new narrative that you want to put ahead in your story, whether it's to make a sequel possible
or changing established history of a fictional entity
to serve your gains as a writer and supposedly provide more opportunities for your fiction.
Sometimes that will be established because you've seen it happen. Sometimes that's established because the lore of the show would have it a certain way and then they go and change it behind the scenes. So, think about Coronation Street. It's been on for 64 years. How many?
Yeah, there or thereabouts.
We'll just say 64. So we've seen most of the things we've seen on screen happen. So if they retcon them, that's retconning something that we've seen, yeah?
Yeah.
Sometimes there are things that they retcon where they're like, We only told you, like a character, they're unreliable narrators.
Well, this is the difference between retcons and revisions, I think. Because retcon, from what I've been looking at, is literally saying, no, we saw this happen, it was established, this definitely happened
this way, and now we're saying
it happened a different way.
Yeah.
Whereas a revision is more like, oh, well, we didn't say this, we didn't show you this happening, we just led you to believe this happened, but actually it didn't. And it doesn't, in a way, you could argue that what's happening with Toya this week is a bit of a revision, because we didn't. It's really difficult.
We're not going to say.
We did not see her.
We're not going to say. But the other thing that I will point out is that soaps, generally, anything you see, we take to be a reliable narrator. So we're watching the action. We're like a disembodied spirit that's seeing. Through the vision of the camera, we're seeing action take place in front of us. And as far as we know, everything we see happened in real life. But there are some notable exceptions to that. For example, dream sequences.
Yeah.
Also, the time that Vera came back to Jack as a ghost, was that real? We don't know. Was it a vision that Jack had as he was dying in his mind? Don't know.
On the whole, though, you're right. Soaps are supposed to be like a peek through the doors, through the curtains of what's going on in these people's lives that we are supposedly kind of studying and over the course of many, many years. And that's one of the things that makes soaps unique. And to have somebody say, well, actually, what you saw was wrong, or we didn't, we're trying to, things happen different. It does feel like they're trying to trick you. And I think it's harder to get away with it in soaps just because of how close to real life it's supposed to be. Now, I know you can say, well, soaps aren't anything like real life these days. Look at all the murderers that they have in Corrie. But at the end of the day, soap is supposed to be another close to real life.
It's like reality community. Television.
Yeah.
It's like before reality TV existed, you watched a soap.
Yeah.
And so that's why retcons can be very unpopular, isn't it? Because we are led to believe everything we're seeing is true. And so when, and there's kind of like an unspoken kind of, what's the word? Agreement between the viewer and the creator of the show that everything you're seeing really is happening. And so that unspoken bargain, once it gets, you know, reneged upon, you feel cheated, you feel lied to, you feel like everything else comes into question. What really, you know, was that true? Was this true? Now you're saying anything I watch now, you could just wave your magic wand and say it didn't really happen. So should I invest in this story? Is it going to be changed later on? Are they going to say it didn't really happen? So that's why retcons are super unpopular, I think.
Sometimes, you know, in other media, they can be very beneficial. Even going back to things like Sherlock Holmes was killed off in one of his stories.
Oh, and but then that was very Arthur
Conan Doyle brought him back again.
He needed the money.
Well, yes.
That is exactly why.
Well, maybe he says that Corey doesn't need money at the moment. I don't know.
Here's another retcon, and I was trying to work out, because I couldn't really work this out. In Ghostbusters 2,
yes,
the Titanic arrives at New York with a gash in its side. But in real life, it broke in half.
Well.
Now, I haven't been able to work it out because I didn't really look into this too much. Maybe people can let me know. I'm pretty sure that at the time they made the movie Ghostbusters 2, they hadn't found the wreck of the Titanic and they didn't actually know that it broke in half. Know. But eyewitness testimony from the night itself says that the ship broke in half. But people didn't believe them because they'd thought that even though the ship sank, they were still on the train of the Titanic is an amazing ship. There's no way it would have broken in half.
Isn't it?
Everybody must have been crazy who said it broke in half. So that's a real life.
That's an
example of a fictional retcon of a real life thing that really happened, but maybe they didn't really know.
Well, like I said, this is mostly coming from comic books, and comic book lore can be incredibly dense and complicated, especially when you bring in different universes. And apparently, like Alfred in Batman was originally not going to be a family butler for Batman at the beginning or something, and then it later turns out that he was
Batman. He's
the Batman. But yeah, in the first,
he wasn't what? Batman's butler.
He wasn't Alfred.
No,
Bruce Wayne's butler.
Bruce Wayne's butler. He wasn't Batman's butler.
Anyway, so
it's just a coincidence.
The term retcon, according to Wikipedia, where I get all my information from, very reliable.
It was first printed in
reference to the All-Star Squadron, which is a DC Comics superhero team, and apparently the team of heroes back in the 80s were retroactively inserted into the history of DC superheroes, and the series rewrote portions of an already established DC canon published during the 1940s. So they created this team of superheroes and said these are always part of, you know, Batman and Superman's mates. They've always been there. And then the DC universe was retroactively changed to always include these.
And Roy Thomas is the one who used the phrase retcon in the letter column of All-Star Squadron issue 20.
Yeah, so somebody wrote into the comic and said, this is a bit of a retcon. Well done, Roy. That's where it comes from. So it's
if anyone's going to complain about retcon, who originated the term retcon, I am not surprised it was somebody called Roy.
Why?
Because Roy is a established name for somebody who's a bit of a stickler for the rules.
Do you reckon?
In Coronation Street.
Oh, yes, of course. Like, Cropper. So it's quite interesting to me that the idea of the term retcon has only been around 40 years. And it made me think, like, did people notice as much before then? Was it something that people cared about? How long after this letter into the DC Comics did it become, you know, a widely accepted trope that people don't really like?
But this is a very human phenomena. Naming something makes it more real. Like, retcons definitely existed before 1983.
Well, that was quite a few in Corrie.
But we didn't have a word for it, so we couldn't crystallise our ideas surrounding what that meant and how we felt about it before we had the word. Same as, I really genuinely do not think that we would have left the EU if we hadn't had the word Brexit. The word Brexit almost manifested the political movement to get us out. You see what I mean? You name something, you give it power.
Words can be powerful. I've read 1984.
It really genuinely does. So the word retcon has, I think, almost manifested more examples of it since.
Yeah. I mean, of course, now we're living in the internet age and people can go back much more easily and find older fiction in whether there's comics or TV or film or anything. I think probably back in the day, writers thought, well, I'm changing it, but people aren't going to know, or even if they are, they're going to find it more difficult to prove it.
There's definitely something to be said about the period in which this was coined. 1983, the 80s, was a bit of a moment for pop culture, wasn't it? And pop culture, nerdery, those things have only increased. And as fans get... it's easier and easier for fans to connect to each other, these discussions about retcons become more apparent, and also they become more important, and people care more about them because they can... You know, they can network and kind of fish these things out. Do you see what I'm saying?
All their rage about how this isn't how it is supposed to be can be built together.
I mean, fandoms definitely existed, obviously. I'm not trying to say that. But I think that the pop culture kind of like, what cloud of, I don't know, influence has got stronger and stronger since the 80s.
Mm.
And it really is the fans that care about this. I don't think the average person cares about retcons in anything, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm watching a TV show and I have no... I haven't invested, because that's what being a fan is. It's investing in a fictional property, right?
Mm.
If I'm not invested in it, I genuinely don't care. So what if they added a character that never existed? If I enjoy it, I'm going to say that was a good move. But it's the fan base that cares, because they're the ones that have put the time and the effort into learning all of these things about a fictional property that then get sort of undermined. History does a similar thing where, you know, history is recorded by various people and some of them are more reliable than others, but nobody's arguing over who won the Second World War. Nobody's like going, oh, what if Hitler won? Well, they do, it's fiction. But nobody's genuinely trying to say, and if they are, some of them get put in prison depending on what country you live in. You know, it's a very serious thing.
Yeah. It's
Did I just throw you a curveball?
I didn't expect the conversation to be going down this
road. The whole point of a retcon is sometimes you need it to get yourself out of a hole. If you paint yourself into a corner and you can't really work... I think that, like, what I say, Sherlock does this sometimes. Doctor Who does it as well. At the end of an episode, oh no, how will they get out of this?
Well, I mean, if we think back to... Well, guess what?
There's this thing we didn't mention that... gets them out of the problem.
Yeah, a lot of it is more of a revision than a retcon. Well, you just brought up Doctor Who, and that made me think of the Timeless Child stuff they did a couple of years ago towards the end of Jodie Whittaker's time, where they said, well, actually, you thought that William Hartnell was the first incarnation of the Doctor, but actually, there were hundreds and hundreds, infinite number before him, and it turned out that this was a timeless child who was found on Gallifrey. I can't remember. And then... because of that child, that's what made all the Time Lords be able to regenerate. And now that's part of the established canon. And now Russell T. Davis comes in and takes over. It's like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? Because certainly for that one episode, it felt like, oh, this has made a huge splash. It's a big deal. It's for the shock value. And I think sometimes with retcon, they can be a little bit short-sighted and be there for the value.
That's very true.
So one might put that against the Toya storyline. We'll have to see how it goes.
We're not
going to
keep bringing it up.
often there can be a really good reason, and sometimes it doesn't,
because it's a fictional world. It's limited by the imagination and the parameters you set out when you first begin. And sometimes these things are set out like in a way in which you would never imagine they'd become as big as they are. And those initial parameters become incredibly limiting, and you need to work your way out of them.
I'm thinking as well. We went to see Saw 10 in the cinema last year, didn't we? That's which had Jigsaw,
a really culturally important.
Love it. That was set between, what was it, the first and the second movie, or the second and the third? Jigsaw dies in the end of the third film, I'm going
to
say.
You have to have seen all of the movie. Like, only three. Sorry if that's a spoiler, but they've been out for a while.
They have been out for a while. And And that's mega limiting. And they've kept the guy, I can't remember the name of the guy who plays Jigsaw, but he's been able to be in every Jigsaw film since then through flashbacks. But then it was Saw 10 last year that said, well, this is set in this minute time period that you didn't see on screen before. And I went and watched it. It's like, okay, did this really happen? I know you're kind of making it up, but I put that to one side because actually that's probably one of the best Saw films of the whole franchise. So I think if a retcon or a revision gives you something that people say, well, that was bloody brilliant, actually, you can be a lot more forgiving of it.
Yeah.
So I was looking about this on TV Tropes as well. And if you've not seen the website TV Tropes, you really can, because that's a massive rabbit hole that you can get. Have you?
Yes, I love TV Tropes.
It's like, these are some things that happen in various media. There's like
nothing
media.
New under the sun. It's literally explaining every plot device and storyline that's ever existed and how often they appear in various popular media.
Yeah, so there's like a page on retcons, there's a page on revisions, which it calls a continuity alteration that doesn't directly contradict any previous material, which is, I think that a lot of what we've seen in Coronation Street does fall into that. I think when we come and have a look at our examples later, we'll say, is that a retcon? Is it revision? You've also got canon discontinuity, which is where previous events are treated as if they never happened.
I do that with my credit cards.
There's one called Remember the New Guy, which is when a character is introduced but is retconned to have been part of the story all along.
What's that character from The Simpsons, the dog.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a Poochie. Or Roy Simpson, isn't it? He was the teenage son that appears as the side gag during the episode.
He's supposed to believe he's already been there. That stupid kid.
Yeah, there was a little kid that turned up in Married with Children. I think in Coronation Street, the closest that we've had to this is Kelly Crabtree. Because she turned up for the first time on her leaving doing the factory, and we were supposed to believe that she'd been working in the factory. Although I think, having watched it very, very recently on ITV3, there was a line of dialogue which made it sound like she'd only been there for two or three weeks or so. And maybe we'd just not been looking there. But yeah, so that is a related phenomena, isn't it? Anyway, so let's have a look at some examples in Coronation Street.
You've done a very
Street.
Good job of this. I want to just say thank you very much.
I found this quite interesting.
This is really fascinating. So,
I hope people will find this interesting.
You love the archivist department, the archive department
Dream
of
job.
Coronation Street. And there are two archivists currently working on Coronation Street at the moment, Helen Nugent and Dom Corey. And they are both very hardworking. They know exactly what they're talking about. Anytime something might be retconned or revised, I'm going to tell you they knew. It's not because they didn't know.
Yeah.
They're on it. They know exactly what they're talking about. Other archivists who you may have heard of, Darren Little, who was in the role between 1989 and 2000. That was a very long stretch of time. He's probably the most influential.
Most
I would say, famous, influential. He is.
Well, he now works on EastEnders as a writer, doesn't he?
Now, was he a retcon or a revisionist? Because he definitely went in and tinkered a little bit, added some details that weren't there before.
Well, he created his own backstory for a whole host of characters. He wrote novels set in the 50s, 40s. He had the history of the houses all the way back to 1902. I think a few bits of the past lives of Coronation Street came from Eric Rosser, who was the first of Corey's archivists, as far as I can tell, and the one who came before Darren Little, but Darren is the person that we have got to thank for having such a rich Weatherfield history that we can draw upon, but also use to say, well, actually, not that I think we're going to be contradicting anything that has supposedly happened, in 1920 anytime soon.
Also, I just want to add in Mackie Sullivan, who writes the Coronation Street novels.
Currently, yeah.
Currently, there's six in the series. She definitely adds information.
There are 100% retcons in Maggie Sullivan's books, and I wasn't planning to talk about those particularly today because it's a bit of side media, and I don't think it's ever held up to say, well, this is the, the gospel of what happened. But quite interestingly, she has brought in characters or into the past of Weatherfield that have been completely established to have not existed before,
because
she wanted to write a story about, so-and-so having a friend and the adventures that they got up to. then it makes sense to invent this character.
These were all like war, pre-war, post-war, that very narrow band, you know, 40s.
Which a lot has already been written about by Darren Little. So when Maggie Sullivan was commissioned to write these other books that were set in the similar time period, and rather than being completely restrained by what Darren Little has said, this is what happened, she's like, well, I'm going to say this happened. And I don't think there's many people knocking on her door saying, all right, excuse me.
Well, it's because it's... What do we think is canon in Coronation Street? I'm going to say anything we see happen.
Mm.
Anything a character says happened, I don't think you can take as canon.
It'd be nice to be able to.
No, I agree. I see why you say that. But equally, people lie, people make up stories, people get told things. I have a very colourful family history. I'm not sure that all of it's true. Some of the things that have happened in my family's history, don't know if that really did happen. I say like it was true, but just the same way that somebody might perhaps embellish, you know, their teenage years or kind of hide a sordid past, I think sometimes characters say things. You know, Evelyn and Cassie is a really good example. How much of that was a retcon or a revision? How much of it was just unreliable narration from two characters that were trying to hide things that
Mary is the ultimate unreliable narrator on Coronation Street.
And she's not retconning. She's not revising history. She's just lying.
Well, there is something which we'll come to later with Mary that does come across as being a bit of a massive retcon.
A bit of a massive retcon, yeah.
I found an interview talking about Helen, the current archivist, on the Coronation Street Fun Pages website, which was a great site that I think it closed down about 2016
or so.
Add
Team Corey Archive here.
They're great. Like Gemma said, they know.
They're historians. They really genuinely are.
Yeah, I've seen with my own eyes cast members go up to Dom, the other current one, said, look, can I pick your brains about such and such from
Dom
my character?
Dom is just amazing. We've never met Helen. No. We love Dom. He's brilliant. I rate him incredibly highly. He's such a nice guy and he really knows what he's talking about.
Whether or not the archivists have got the power to completely shut down any story ideas, I don't know, but I'm sure they were very much consulted for Toya's storyline at the
moment. They would have been consulted, but I would say that there's not... They don't have the final say. And
if Ian McLeod went in with an agenda of, I want Toya to have buried a baby under a bush, any kind of little crack that could have happened if, then they were going to
That's how you get the pearl out of the oyster with a crack.
Yeah. Do you want to read some of this interview with Helen, which talks a little bit about what the archivists do?
Coronation Street Fun Pages. What was this?
This is a website. I told you about it.
Okay, it's a website.
Yeah.
And so this interview, this is what she said. This is the reason for the files and lists, etc. And I am constantly making notes of things as I read scripts. Then often the writers will email me with things like, has it ever been established that so-and-so has an aunt in Bournemouth? I can then look in their character's file and find a mention of that aunt. I can also have a section in each file for little oddities like Amy's milk allergy and the fact that Ken is vegetarian. It does get tricky from time to time, but the thing is, it is a work of fiction. And sometimes the producer will tweak history a little in order to have a good storyline. For instance, we may change someone's birthday so they can have it on the day we go to air. We know diehard fans get upset if we change events of the past, and quite rightly so. And we do try very hard to stick to Coronation Street's rich history. But sometimes, if we have a story we want to tell, can't be helped. I may not always agree with it, but ultimately, it is their decision.
There we go. That bit about the birthdays.
Very diplomatic.
Bit about the birthdays is interesting because they generally will try and stick to characters having roughly the same birthday, but if an episode falls like one day before or after the established birthday, that character will be having their birthday on that day.
And there's, I'm just going to say too, there is an absolute wish-washery of the timeline on Coronation Street for the past, what are we going to say, 4-5 years, where you can never really absolutely 100% be sure what day of the week the activity is happening. Just because it's broadcast on a Monday, say it's done on Wednesday 24th of April, doesn't mean that you're supposed to believe that in the world of Weatherfield that was truly a Wednesday.
And that the following day will be a Thursday.
That's not how it works. They're really,
I wish it did, because that's one of my major bugbears.
It really is frustrating if you're getting really in-depth and granular about Coronation Street. But for the average person who's watching it, I don't think they care.
Mm. So let's dive on in and have a look at some examples from Corrie's history. And I've tried to categorise these together, and I want to start
You've
off
done a really
by
good job
looking
this. It's
at
really
characters who should not exist.
Yeah.
And the number one for me is Adam Barlow.
Yeah.
And we're going to so we can talk about, you know, is it worth the retcon to make him that made him exist? But basically, he should have been aborted. He was on screen aborted, but he was very strongly implied that the abortion happened.
Yeah, you can't say he should have been aborted because that sounds really rude.
We were told that he had been aborted.
But are we going to go through these and like make our, are we going to give a verdict of retcon or revision?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
If you want to. So his mum was Susan Barlow, Ken's daughter, the sister to Peter. But she married Mike Baldwin and got pregnant in 1987. Now, she was very career-driven, wasn't
pregnant.
She? So some might say that, but of course not you. She didn't want to be tied down. She was career-minded. She wanted to be just as much of a business person
as
Mike was. She didn't want to be a mum. But Mike was like, no, you are being a mum. He didn't like the idea of having such a strong-willed woman as his wife. I think he liked the idea of having the trophy of Ken's, his arch-rival's daughter as a wife, just to wind Ken up.
Yep.
But she was like, no, I'm going to have an abortion.
Well, Mike was a very... politely say traditional man, he would have no input whatsoever on child raising.
No.
So him having a baby is the same way I would love to have a baby. Get someone pregnant, no influence
they
whatsoever. Turn up every year for the birthday, maybe it depends on what day that you're filming. Maybe you're not there when it's the actual birthday. Sounds brilliant to me.
So she went off to London, came back saying she had had an abortion, and the news of that caused the Baldwins' relationship to fall apart. Susan ended up moving to Newcastle. So this was part of Susan Baldwin's exit storyline. And we were then led to believe, you know, for many, many years after this, there's no reason to think that this abortion hadn't happened. Ken even went to visit Susan up in Newcastle numerous times in the following years. Like, I think there was one story where Tracy ran away from home and she went to ended up in Newcastle, so she was staying with Susan for a bit. Susan was supposed to have been at Peter's wedding to Jessica in 1990, although we didn't even see Peter on that episode there, if I remember rightly, let alone Susan, just Ken turned up. There was no mention of this baby having actually existed, but in 2001, the character of Adam was introduced when he wasn't played by Sam, but he was played by Ian Dacascos. And it was established that Susan didn't have an abortion after all. She didn't want to go through with it, but she also didn't want Mike to know about the fact that he had a son. So it was kept very, very hush-hush. And then there was a bit of a story over the course of a few weeks about her still trying to keep it from him, but eventually he finds out. And then that leads to another Susan-related retcon, which we'll get to later. So yeah, Adam was invented by this story just to bring, you know, just to bring another Barlow/Baldwin into the family. What's your thoughts about this?
This is really a borderline case because it's not really a retcon because it's plausible that she lied. But why would she lie? Why wouldn't she ask for support from this rich guy who could have given her child support? And also, why would everybody be sworn to secrecy about going to visit her multiple times and never mentioning that Adam was there? Unless he was, like, locked up like the monster in Glam's castle in Scotland, where he's just, like, this horrible, nasty, deformed being that gets put into a side room and never mentioned.
I can't remember when Susan was brought back in 2001 and Adam was first brought into it, whether...
Mind you, Scotland, Ken... Adam, Glam's...
Well, exactly.
Monster.
I don't think that Ken was supposed to have been keeping it a secret. I think it was just as news to him as it was to Mike.
So Ken didn't know, even though he'd been there. So Susan's like, oh no, the relatives are visiting.
Into it too quickly because
child.
I think that this really does rely on us
not
going back
too
to
hard.
This willing suspension of disbelief and not thinking too hard about it. But
It's not a retcon because it could have happened.
Yeah, so it's a day revision, but it's a
very,
big one.
Very,
very, very unlikely.
It requires a lot
turn of events
of imagination.
I think whether people accept retcons and revisions as well depends on whether you watched it when you were told the original.
Okay.
Version of the history.
I'm going to say two things about what my personal acceptance of a retcon / revision is. Did I see it happen? That's a big one.
Versus did you read about it having happened?
No. Did I see it happen? In which case I'm less likely to accept that what I saw was not correct. Mm. Secondly, did it facilitate a really good story? Now, the return of Adam Barlow as a character, is it worth that revision? I'm going to say yes.
I think you know, looking at it in the long term, Adam Barlow has become quite a key person in the list of, you know,
and I think
the Corey annals of history.
Don't you have to get out your, I said this recently, Libra scales here, and you go, one side is how much of a suspension of disbelief you need to have, and that weighs it down. And the other side is, how good is the result? Mm. And sometimes Corey is unbalanced very, very highly in favour of you saying, well, that wasn't worth it at all.
Mm.
But on the whole, I think they do a good job of keeping it, you know, okay, I'm going to accept this because I just kind of liked how it went.
I think I prefer the original actor to play Adam, to be honest. I don't really like the ladies' man player that we've got with a new version.
I am sad.
And he's not a character that I really, really enjoy, but I will say he's been an important part of Coronation Street's history in the last 20 years.
I'm going to say I'm really sad that the whole Adam versus Daniel as a proxy for Mike versus Ken, that never got developed, because they really set them up for that. You had Daniel, who's the nerdy square, who's got ambitions for greater life and looks down on his neighbours.
Mm.
And you had Adam as like the player, businessman, out for himself, cutthroat, doesn't care who gets in his way, do anything to get on top. I still think there's so much potential for those two to become proper rivals, but they haven't done it.
Mm. Mm.
Just saying, if you want an idea.
So, talking of characters that don't exist, Adam's not the only Baldwin-adjacent family member that really shouldn't be here right now. In fact, all of the extended Baldwin clan who arrived on the cobbles in 2004 really shouldn't exist. So we are talking Danny Baldwin, Frankie Baldwin, Warren Baldwin, and the other Baldwin, Jamie Baldwin. Because it had been firmly established back in the 80s or 70s, I don't remember, that Mike Baldwin was an only child. But when Danny Baldwin appeared, the character of Harry Baldwin was invented, who was supposedly Mike's brother. Yeah, so he didn't have a brother, but for the purpose of this storyline, he did. And then Danny was supposedly the son of Harry Baldwin. And then as the plot goes on, it turns out that Mike was actually Danny's father because he'd had it off with Harry's wife, Viv.
Okay, I'm going to say it's not necessarily outside of possibility, of like a very, very real possibility that you could have a half-sibling you don't know about, because that's how biology works. I really am waiting for the retcon / revision of a DNA test revealing an entire branch of some mega important Coronation Street family to have an entire extra group of people that get revealed by somebody's infidelity.
This isn't it. This is literally saying, oh no, Mike did have a brother all along. He had a brother. Which that really does stick in my craw a little bit.
You can't
because
just
we
not
have been
that's
more egregious than the Adam Barlow abortion thing, because well, you know, we didn't see her have the abortion. Although I don't like it, but with this, it's like no, he didn't have a brother. It even made things more complicated because Mike's dad was called Frankie Baldwin, and then in comes Frankie Baldwin, who's a woman, who's the wife of Danny Baldwin. It's very, very confusing.
Right, so Danny Baldwin is the son of Harry, who is...
No, he's actually the son of Mike, but when he came into it, he was the son of Mike's brother. Right?
So he had an affair with his brother's wife.
Mike did, yeah.
Mike had an affair with his brother's wife and sired a child.
His non-existent brother's wife, yeah.
that so he when, believed was his nephew. Well, did he think it was his nephew, or did he know?
Yeah, no, he. Oh gosh, I can't remember. I can't remember how it was. It's
supposedly his nephew, but really his son.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That I mean, that's by the by. That doesn't particularly
matter, does it?
It's whether or not we accept that because of this extra brother being invented, we are accepting of the fact that the whole extra branch of the Baldwin family tree exists. And it's a difficult one, because when you look back at the impact that those characters had on Coronation Street history, it was a bit of a flash in the pan, wasn't it? They were in the show for, what, 2-3 years, maybe?
I did like the Baldwin.
But they were quite entertaining when they were there.
They were all Cockney.
Yeah.
And one of them was played by
Bradley Walsh.
Bradley Walsh, who is
that was Danny Baldwin.
Very famous. The thing is, this is why I think that Corey is canny at the moment with not fleshing out details. Like, we never really got under the skin of what happened with Spider and his wife and his daughter. Because in the future, maybe they will bring them back and they will have a story.
Mm.
So the fact that Mike Baldwin's saying, "I'm an only child," I don't think they do that now, because it just kind of like makes a cul-de-sac for that story. You can't then, and nobody says, "I'm an only child" when they're not.
Mm.
But some people, but I will say, some people do have sisters or brothers that they just don't talk about because they're not.
Yeah, exactly. There have been a few other appearing and disappearing siblings, which we'll get to later. This whole Baldwin clan arrival also brought about another retcon relating to Mike's dad, because back in July 1982, when the OG Frankie Baldwin passed away, we find out that he'd just been found collapsed on his home, and he died before the ambulance got there. But in 2002, when Mike celebrated his 60th birthday, he said that his father's death had occurred whilst playing golf. So this character has had two different variations of how he died.
Which one do you think is real? It could be something completely different to both those stories.
I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, it doesn't particularly matter, because again, who's going to remember, apart from the hardcore, this is how Frankie Baldwin died?
It's interesting.
It does niggle me a bit that when they even do need to change these small details, even though it's a character that we barely saw and don't hold that much, you know, affection for.
So this one is a revision. It's not a retcon, because Mike Baldwin said, "I'm an only child." It doesn't mean he is an only child.
No,
I'm going to say, listen, I've got a very specific definition of what a retcon is. If I've seen it on screen and then they say it didn't happen, I'm going to say that's the only way you can really call something a retcon.
But I can't remember how it came about in the 80s. Like, if Mike just happened to say it as a throwaway line, yeah. But if there was a scene where Mike and his dad were saying, "You know, we're just a close family, aren't we? It's only me and you. You know, I never had any brothers." If we had these two family members having a conversation about the fact that Mike is the only spawn of Frankie Baldwin.
No, you're wrong. I'm sorry, but you're wrong. Anytime somebody says something, it doesn't mean it's true.
No, you're wrong. But what would be the reason for the two characters to lie about it?
It's entirely irrelevant. I'm not being horrible. I'm not trying to diminish the impact of a revision versus a retcon. But what I'm trying to get into, I'm trying to really winkle out the difference, is that a retcon happened in front of your face. Are you going to tell me that if you stood there and you watched, this is graphic, Mike Baldwin's mum's vagina, her entire life, and only one child came out, you think that's more impactful than him saying, "I'm an only child," or his dad saying,
"Sometimes you've just got to believe what the characters are saying."
No, you can't. You can't believe everything they say. I say things all the time that aren't true.
If we have to take everything that any character ever says with a grain of salt, then
you do.
No, that's what makes
it interesting.
Okay.
That's what makes it so grey. That's why I like the show, because when two people are talking, and don't forget, Michael, everybody lives their own experience of life. Everybody lives in a world that they created themselves. Reality isn't real. I'm blowing your mind right now.
You're going to be explaining,
but you generate your own reality,
right,
based on your experiences. Everybody experiences things differently, and the reality is what you see, not what you say.
Right, let's move on. Another character
we can't get past
should
this.
Not exist. Another character who shouldn't exist.
I'm so mad at you.
Don't be. Martin Chavasky, right?
Right, please write in, what do you think?
Yeah, support.
You're the only people that can resolve it.
So we were watching the DVDs a couple of years ago, and then we got to the 1980s, and then this character of Martin Chavasky popped up. Do you remember this guy? We're getting a shaking head here.
No.
So this was supposed to be somebody who was a grandson of Elsie Tanner, born to Linda and Ivan Chavasky in 1964. So they already had their own son, Paul, who was born in 1961. But then when, in 1980, this Martin guy turns up on Elsie's doorstep saying, "Hey, Grandma, I'm coming to stay with you for 6 months. We were supposed to go, "Oh, okay, fine, there's another Chavasky here." But it doesn't make any sense, because this was the very first time that there was ever any reference to Linda and Ivan having a second son. Again, the Chavaskys had come to Weatherfield. I mean, they moved away from Weatherfield in the early 60s, but they came and made the odd visit here and there over the following 20 so years without another child. And so 1980, this grown extra son turns up saying, "Hey, Grandma," that's a proper Roy Simpson kind of example for me. So anyway, he ends up working under Len in the builder's yard, and he has a relationship, an unsuccessful relationship, with someone working at Baldwin's Casuals, and then he buggers off by the end of the year. But yeah, this brand new made up grown character who up until 1980 supposedly doesn't exist. What do you say about that?
What do you think I'm going to say?
Well, as with pretty much everything that's going to be coming up now, revision, but do you care about that?
I do care. I don't want anyone to listen to this and think that I think a revision is okay.
Acceptable. Okay.
It's not acceptable, but I really, really want to drill down on the difference between a retcon and a revision, because I think you should be mad about retcons, but maybe you can be mad about both. But a retcon is just, personally, I think, kind of unforgivable. A revision is just creative hand waving. And like I said before, depends on what you get out of it. Don't think the character of Martin Chavasky was really worth saying that Elsie had a grandson that she didn't give a crap about. We've watched some episodes in the 60s, early 60s, where she was besotted with her grandson who was born in Canada, who went to Canada. She loved him so much. Any time, there were some really hilarious scenes where she's just totally captivated by the even the concept that he exists, that she ignores Dennis.
Mm.
So the idea that she would just never say, "I've got a lovely grandson called Martin," just doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense, but it could have happened. That's the difference.
Martin, to me, is a little bit of a Daisy Midgley, because we went many, many years without any knowledge of the fact that Jenny supposedly had a stepdaughter.
Yeah.
And then when she rocked up in, what was it, 2020, 2021, I can't remember, saying, hey,
mum.
Step-mum,
yeah.
I'm part of your family. Remember that? And we were all supposed to believe and accept that. And that, to me, at the beginning, was very, very difficult to accept. I think, well, why wouldn't Jenny have ever mentioned this? Why would there have been no photos? Why, you know, why?
But can I point out the difference between a character who turns up and says, "Hey, when you weren't in the show, we were really close, and I'm your family member"? That's different from them saying, "I'm Daisy, I've been here the whole time."
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
So does Daisy's existence bother you? Do you remember whether it did bother you when she first came into it?
Again, it's one of those things, but okay, it depends on what kind of a person you are. Like, if you spoke to me on a day-to-day basis, you wouldn't know I even had a mother. I love her dearly. I speak to her every day. She's like one of the most important people in my whole life. But I don't talk about her all the time. But you know, I was born of a mother, because everyone is.
It just seems like it's the sort of thing, you know, when Johnny and Jenny got married, for example, why wasn't Daisy invited? And
yeah, I know.
It doesn't really make sense.
Revisions don't necessarily make sense, but they could have happened.
Mm.
A retcon couldn't have happened. Can you see the difference now?
Yeah, of course, of course. No, I get it. I get it. I've got one other...
What do you think of Martin then? Revision or retcon?
Revision, totally. Totally revision.
Are you
but
on board
that...
with my definition
yeah,
of
Yeah, I am,
two?
But I just... I'm
not saying you can't be mad about a revision.
Okay, yeah, fine.
Okay, we're back on the
I would say that Martin's inclusion on the programme wasn't worth the revision.
No, it
because
wasn't.
If Corey, or any, you know, story writer...
He was in 34 episodes.
Yeah, if any story writer says, well, believe this revision, believe this happened, you just didn't see it. If they continue to do it too much, then you start to lose trust in them, don't you?
And
then I don't think that Martin was an important enough character to have wasted that on.
But can I give an example, a parallel, for viewers who don't know much about Elsie Tanner? It would be like... Carla had a nephew called Bobby, but she knew he existed the entire time he was alive and just never mentioned him, and then he turned up.
Yeah,
that's what it would be like. Elsie Tanner was an even more important character to Coronation Street than Carla is now, and then suddenly they manufactured a grandson.
Mm.
So there you go.
Yeah, Bobby's not... Bobby is, as you know, people say what they like about him, but at least Carla didn't know, and there's no reason why she should have known that he existed.
And I don't know very much about... it was Paul, wasn't it?
What?
Paul Javeski.
Paul Javeski, yeah.
I don't know very much about Paul. I don't know why he couldn't have just been Paul. I'm sure somebody will tell me why.
No, I think that is a bit of a mystery. That could very well have just been a grown-up Paul, but they decided to invent a different son just for the sake of it. I don't know. Another character, and this one does get on my goat, and we talked about this properly.
Gets on your goat? Where's it go? Rides off to in the sunset, probably.
Yeah.
Flipping you the bird.
So, Christian Gatley should not exist. So, this is Hayley's son. We talked about him recently on the podcast. Because I remember watching when Hayley went to bed with Roy for the first time. Both of them said to each other that they were virgins. Hayley said, I was pure as the driven snow. But then 10 years later... following the funeral of Hayley's auntie Monica, she finds out that she's actually got a son who she fathered back when she was Harold. So when she was telling Roy she was a virgin when she met him, she wasn't saying 100% complete virgin. She just meant a virgin since I became a woman.
Well, since I transitioned.
Yeah, exactly. And that really did not sit right with me because
she was always
everything about Roy's and Hayley's love story was so perfect and special, and viewers were taken on this special journey with them, and we saw them fall in love and to say, oh, actually, no. And that's an example of Christian, of throwing something in for a bit of a shock value mm-hmm. to get a brief, like, hey, look at this, she has got a son. But then it's not memorable at the end. It wasn't a nice character. A couple of months later, he was gone again. That, to me, wasn't worth it.
Again, not a retcon, because she could have been not lying, but being economical with the truth. Genuinely, I believe that she believed what she said when she told him. I don't think you can call Hayley into question when she told Roy that. But sadly, the existence of Christian as a character does undermine Hayley as a character, I think.
It makes you either say that it wasn't a retcon, or you give it, or you kind of say, well, yeah, she was willfully deceiving Roy, because
I know, and this plays
she
into
knew
that.
What Roy would take away from that.
Yes, I know, and this is why I find it unpleasant, because it feeds into that transphobic trope of deception by trans people. And it's unfortunate, because Hayley, in almost every other respect, is an incredibly positive portrayal of a trans person in Britain, so much so that she even caused laws to be changed as a character.
Mm.
So to undermine that very strong portrayal of a trans character with this narrative that she was... you can't really beat around the bush. She was deceptive when she told Roy that she was a virgin.
I mean, you could even say she hadn't been living as a woman for very long before Roy even met her.
She had surgery.
So what we're now to believe is what she was actually saying was, in the last not very long at all, I haven't got my end away since then.
But. Neither had he. I mean, it's a retcon. I think it's a really poor example of... Not a retcon, sorry, it's a revision. A really poor example of one in Coronation Street. I cannot defend this whatsoever. I hated it at the time. In retrospect, I still find it to be an inexcusable. So I
as a character as beloved and honest and pure as Hayley was supposed to be, it was just a bit of a black stain on her.
It wasn't. It just didn't. I mean, and also, you know, I don't want to be disparage anybody who's been in a situation the same way that Hayley was. It's much more complicated than you or I will ever understand. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad about their own circumstances or try to cast dark shadows on anybody's real life. But this is a fictional character that represented like the ideal of what a trans person would be, to show what they were to the public that generally didn't understand or was openly hostile to what that meant. So to then go back in, I mean, is it a testament to how accepting people are of trans people that they could go back and rewrite history in a way to undermine the character? You could argue, I don't know that I would. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think of ways to excuse what happened. Yeah. But if I had been in any kind of capacity of decision making, I would have said, we're absolutely not doing this. It has no benefit at all.
None
whatsoever.
So let's move on from characters.
I mean, they could have done the same story by having her have donated sperm. They could have done the same story that way.
Yeah.
When she was broke, she needed money, maybe to fund. I don't know.
I probably would have preferred that. That would have sat a lot better with me.
It would. Anyway, really,
like I was saying, let's move on from characters who shouldn't exist to characters who should exist. And all around the character of Ivy Brennan.
Yeah.
She, like, there's characters here that are 100% retcon. And when you think about retcons on Corey, there's just no escaping this. So when
the power of Ivy Brennan.
When she arrived on the show. And she was Ivy Tildesley back then. Oh, no, she was actually Ivy Tildesley, as in Catherine Tildesley. So her surname was spelt differently at the beginning, which was later retconned to be Tildesley.
That's how you get away with cheque fraud.
That wasn't the big one. The big one is that she spoke about her husband called Arthur. Right?
So haven't we all had one of those?
She herself was a very different character back then. If you think about what Ivy became, the kind of mother-in-law from hell, harridan, uptight Catholic, she was much more of a good time girl back in the early days, and we've not seen very much of that.
Isn't that the origin story of like 50% of Catholic harridans?
Maybe. But anyway, she was married to
speaking as a daughter of Catholics, just saying, I'm allowed to say it.
She was married to Arthur, but then a few years later, like what, 4 or 5 years later, in 1975, we meet her husband, and now he's called Jack.
What?
So she was married to Arthur, then he was completely erased from existence. Jack came onto the show, and he just was on the show for 2 episodes. It was in the lead up to the warehouse fire, you know, where what's her face? Fred G's wife got killed.
In my contrary nature, I have to ask you a question. Who called him Jack? Do you know?
Well, Ivy. He just was Jack Walker. You're not trying to explain away.
No, I'm not trying to. I'm just being contrary. I'm just saying that I know some people in that era, in the old days, used to have different names.
Mm.
I'm just saying, some people use their middle name as their main name, and their first name was like their real name, but nobody used it. So was it Arthur Jack? Jack Arthur?
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because in 1979, Ivy's third husband, yet still supposed to be the first one, comes on the scene. And this is Bert Tildesley, who then stayed her husband. The thing with Ivy is she wasn't such a big character throughout the first 10 years. She was very much a kind of side character working at the factory, didn't see a whole lot of her. But then they wanted to up Lynn Perry's role on the show, and rather than saying you're still married to Jack, Bert came along, and they had a 21-year-old son, Brian.
Are we just going to ignore...
This is a retcon.
No, listen. Are we going to ignore the existence of the very tried and true Christian, British Christian name, Arthur but Jack?
These are different people. And it's not just... You could argue that recastings were a type of retcon, I suppose, couldn't you?
You really could.
It's been retcon because they didn't look the same. But no, this was a different character.
That's a can of worms we're not opening.
This was established that they had been married For since 1956, they'd lived in Inkerman Street together. So this this previous husband that we saw on screen was erased from existence.
Right.
And it was clearly established in the dialogue back when Jack was on the show that Ivy didn't have a son.
So Bert Brennan.
No, it was Don Brennan, wasn't it? This is Bert Tilsley. So Ivy was Tilsley, first married to Arthur Tilsley, then Jack Tilsley, and then Bert Tilsley.
But Bert was the real one.
He was the final one. He was Tilsley. Yes.
So I do know that Coronation Street, when they come up with the character's name, they do look and see, in the vicinity of Manchester, is there a real person who has this same name? And sometimes they will, like Pat, for example, Pat Phelan was not called Pat originally. He had a different first name, which escapes me presently. But they changed it because there was actually a man called that. Was there someone called Arthur Tilsley, Jack Tilsley?
No, I don't think so. But I think that Jack name didn't stick because of Jack Duckworth. I can't remember when Jack came into the show, but I think when
it was
when Jack Tilsley was in it, there wasn't a Jack Duckworth, and it would have been a bit more confusing to have, you know, best buddies Vera and Ivy both have husbands called Jack. So it makes total sense, but it was still
utter retcon.
This is a retcon.
Yes, I agree. That's a retcon.
Yeah. Bill Podmore, who's a producer back then, joked in his memoirs that he made Ivy a bigamist when he created Bert. He said, her original husband, Jack, though rarely seen, was played by an actor called Bert Gaunt. There was no death or divorce. He simply faded away. Bert Gaunt took a very professional attitude to the breakup of his screen marriage and simply sent a light-hearted telegram saying, if Ivy didn't mind, he'd just call round now and then and claim his conjugal rights.
Right.
So out of everything we've talked about so far, this is 100% a retcon. I'd love to know what people of the time thought when he turned up. Or, you know, there was a gap of 4 or 5 years between them. How many people actually remember? Because like we said, people weren't cataloguing it back then. There was you didn't have it on tape.
That's the big difference. And the fact that
yeah, and the fact that Jack had only appeared in these two episodes, probably a lot of people forgot about
it. And I also just want to point out that even now, many of these episodes, I mean, some of them are on YouTube, but the early 60s are completely irretrievable to most people. Like, nobody knows. Like, you can read the Choropedia updates, but
yeah,
we can't access them, unfortunately. No. So,
but you can see this episode with Jack Tilsley because it is the warehouse fire, and a lot of the 70s were in it.
Yeah, it's on the
DVD. So other characters who should exist but don't, a couple of Ogdens.
Oh, I love the Ogdens. Trevor and Sylvia were siblings, weren't they?
Yeah, siblings of
Irma
and who's the other one? Tony Ogden. No,
I don't remember.
Oh, actually, no, sorry, I'm wrong there. So Tony is... No. It's Tony and Sylvia are the ones that should exist. But now the current continuity is that there is only Trevor and Irma. So basically, half of the Ogdens' children have popped out of existence since the family were first brought into the show.
So they appeared in like the early 60s, didn't they?
The Ogdens did,
They're not original characters.
No, okay. 1963, 64.
So 64. The original story was that Stan... You know, this is the kind of thing that used to pass as hilarious plot points. Stan beat them so much when he was drunk that they were taken into care, Trevor and Sylvia.
Tony and Sylvia.
And they never appeared on screen. There was supposed to be a mention of when they moved in episode 372. It was supposed to have Tony in it, but because of this ITV strike, they never recorded it.
No, there's no episode that we can watch, even if the 60s episodes were readily available, which, like you said, they're not. There's no episode that was filmed that showed the Ogdens moving into Coronation Street. They get the house, and lots of people have seen that as Hilda's first appearance, but then it's not until later in the year that they move in. But that moving episode doesn't exist, but it was written, and it had Tony Ogden in it.
And he was
even cast. Yeah. But then the strike happens.
But Tony never existed as a character. The only two canonical children of the Ogdens are Trevor and Irma.
Yeah,
and of those, only Irma ever appeared.
No, I think Trevor appeared briefly.
Oh, right.
I think he's been in it a little
maybe
bit.
Maybe you should have read this out then.
Yeah, maybe I should have done. But yeah, so these characters were invented, referenced on screen.
Yeah.
But then
I don't remember. Later I've never,
canon, they never existed.
We've only seen what we can find on YouTube and the DVD episodes that are available, and yeah, I've never seen Trevor. I've seen Irma. You know I love her.
Love Irma.
But she does also, she really does have, maybe it's me because I'm also an only child, she has that only child aura of confidence.
So are we saying that that Tony and Sylvia Ogden are also revisions and not retcons because we didn't actually see them on screen? But the or even though they were referenced.
I don't really know what to say about these two. I don't know what to say about this because I don't really have any information about how they were mentioned.
Well, they just said, you know, our Trevor and our Sylvia are going to come and live with us or
then
something.
Then it's revision.
Something along those lines, yeah.
If you saw them on screen and then they never existed, that's different.
I can't remember whether there was like a photo that was supposed to be of one of them. I don't know whether I'm completely making that up, but...
It's a revision.
It's a revision, but one that does irk. But it's, then I don't. Looking back on it now, I don't need there to have been any more Ogdens.
No, and I also do love Irk Ogden. My favourite.
So similar lines to this, we do have a few examples of appearing and disappearing siblings over the year. So, for example, in July 2020, Tim Metcalf.
When you said that, I just got real big vibes of the comic guy off of The Simpsons. Going, why? Excuse me, an episode 10,094
in July 2020.
It was clearly stated.
Tim says that he's an only child, but in 2013, 7 years earlier, he said that he had two older brothers named Christopher and Craig. So,
my problem
don't know
with
what's
this,
happened since then.
My problem with this is that depending on when you catch me and what you're asking me, I will tell you I'm an only child or I'll tell you that I had two brothers and a sister because I kind of did and I kind of didn't. Like, they were my foster siblings. They were my cousins. I live with them. It was a very, what's the word? A period of time in your life when things are much more important and add to your development. What is that? What's that definition?
Yeah, there is a word.
It was. It's kind of a seminal
formative
point in my
years.
Life. Yeah, and in which they lived with us as my siblings, and we acted like siblings. You know, I was the oldest. All of a sudden, I used to smack them around the head. They used to like annoy me.
So what we're saying here is maybe this Christopher and Craig.
They could have been fosters. They could have been foster brothers.
Interesting that that was never brought up with Elaine or Jeff.
But I don't. But the thing is, though, when I bring this up, I don't feel the need to give my entire family history about why it is that sometimes I will say that I'm not an only child and sometimes I am.
Mm.
I will. Like, I am an only child, but I'm also not.
Yeah. Also, another character who had... Well, this is a character who had a sibling pop out of nowhere. Emily Nugent. Now, she had many sisters, did Emily. Emily Bishop. But in episode 810 of Coronation Street, she tells Reverend James that she has no brothers, yet it is later established that she has one called Edgar. So did she just forget about him? Are we supposed to believe that, Coronation Street?
Revision.
So I hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
What an idiot. Secret parents. We have secret parents, yeah. Fred and Ashley. This was a good twist.
Well, there's been an increasing number. Every now and then, yeah. They like to say, oh, these characters are actually a parent of this character. And it all started with, I think, Fred and Ashley. And how do you feel about the use of secret parents as a plot device?
It's not a retcon. I love it. I think it's great. But only because we overthink Coronation Street in general. So we'll sit there and sometimes we'll be like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if so-and-so and so-and-so was actually secretly blah blah's dad or mum or something.
Mm.
Because it is really fun. I think... Isn't this just like a symptom of like just being a human being? You look for patterns where there aren't any. That's like the human condition. We're always trying to connect things that don't necessarily get connected. And so in fiction, when that happens, it's super satisfying, even if maybe it's kind of like satisfying in the same way that eating chips are. Might not be really good for you and you shouldn't do it very often, but when you do, it's really nice.
So there's been a few examples of this on Coronation Street. I think Fred and Ashley are the biggest. It wasn't actually the first, but it was the first one that I ever saw. And I grew up watching Coronation Street around the time that Fred Elliott first came into the show. And for many, many years, Fred was Uncle Fred to Ashley.
Yeah.
But in 1999...
So it's 1994
yeah.
to 1999.
So there were 5 years that yeah. these two were uncle and nephew, although, oh, you know, in the early years they weren't.
I really wish I could have seen this.
It was a really big deal.
So you watched this really... You watched this
yeah.
happen?
Yeah.
And you didn't have any idea?
I don't think so.
And what did you think? Were you like...
I think it will often depend on how well the script shows it yep. and how well the actors involved portray it, and what they do with it afterwards.
We've established that John Savardin, we highly, highly rate him. He was an incredible dramatic actor. He was mostly used comedically on Coronation Street as Fred. But when they gave him something dramatic to do, he rose to the occasion magnificently.
Well, they were a really lovely double act.
Yeah.
In the first 5 years and beyond. And I think when Fred accidentally reveals to Audrey in 1999, I've got a son, and then a bit later it turns out that it's Ashley, I think a lot of the viewers were like, oh, that's so sweet. Because Ashley, I think it had been established that he'd had a mum who he'd grown up with, and then there was a whole story of like having to go and see her and say, oh, you weren't really my mum, but you raised me and all this. But I think people just love the idea of Ashley and Fred being close family, and so to have them even closer, it just worked.
Yeah, there is a danger that you accidentally undermine the importance of other familial relationships, because there's no real reason why it shouldn't be deeply touching that a nephew and an uncle are very close. But somehow we can't escape that biological urge to feel that everybody should be related to each other yeah, in order to have yeah. a very strong relationship.
And then you have like Fred going to Ashley and Maxine's wedding, and you can see he's just that extra level, a bit proud.
I know, it does make me sad. It makes me kind of sad as somebody who doesn't have that many biological relatives to think nobody really cares about me because they're not related to me. But you've got to let it go, haven't you?
So that one worked really well for me. Johnny and Carla. So this was... I don't know whether I would properly count this, because it was within the first 3 months or so of Johnny being on the show that it was revealed that he was actually Carla's father. So I think, you know, with Fred and Ashley, when
Carla
they were...
Carla Barla's father.
Yes. When when Fred and Ashley were brought into it, they were 100%... uncle and nephew. That's how they were written. And then I think somebody had the idea, oh, what if they were father and son? But with Johnny and Carla, I think that he came into it and it was just like, well, here's a secret that he's got, in a few months' time we'll reveal it. So I wouldn't even particularly count this as a revision, but it is another example of somebody finding that the person that they believed was their father all along is actually not. And Johnny is Carla's father, which is fine to me.
Yes.
But
not retcon.
Not really. We saw that Johnny came in and that Kate and Aidan were his siblings, were his children. And I think in a weird way, looking back on them, I still see them as being more his real children than Carla is. I see a distinction there. Do you not at all? Because I see Carla as being a late coming child.
I'm not getting
to
involved
Johnny,
in this.
Even though she's a more of a main character. And I didn't see that closeness of relationship between them as I did between Ashley and Fred even.
I think sometimes the trouble with soaps is that they force you to have an opinion on things that aren't your business.
Oh, I know. You also had Danny and Mike Baldwin. We talked about this earlier, didn't we? The fact that Danny was supposedly Mike's nephew, later turned out to be his son. That whole Baldwin clan were brought in to facilitate Johnny Briggs' exit story, and they were only in it within a few years. So again, I think possibly when they were brought into it, it had been decided behind the scenes that Danny was going to be his son rather than his nephew.
Right.
But I don't know, I can't remember. Steve and Emma is a more recent example, isn't it?
Now, I love this because this... Was it driven by fan theories?
I think fans made this happen, I'm going to say.
I mean, we never got to see Ali and Ryan getting it on, but we got to see Steve being Emma's dad.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2019, a year after Emma had first appeared on the show, we found out that Emma was Fiona's daughter and that she had given birth to her after Fiona left the street after... She was dating Steve, and Steve had an affair with Maxine.
Yes.
So, this was not the original plan, and Ali Mardell said this in a 2018 interview, that because she said, I've heard the Fiona and Steve daughter theory, and it's definitely not true, but I did have a little chat and a joke with Angela Griffin about it, and that's quite funny. So a year before, it was not canon, and then next, the following year, they had established that they were father and daughter.
So this is a completely acceptable revision, I think, would say.
I think the fact that, I mean, it doesn't it show be careful what you wish for?
Mm.
I really do think that, fans made it happen. Sorry.
I don't think I'd like it if that sort of thing happened all the time. It is a shame that Emma only stayed in the show for a few years.
It really
and now
is.
It's like a little facet of Steve's family that we can go back to forgetting about now.
And I mean, you know, you guys know, if you're a regular listener to the show, how many times we come up with crackpot theories and connections to things that never get picked up by the show or don't ever happen. They're just flights of fancy. If every single time we said something ridiculous that turned out to be true, this show would be more fantastical than Spider-Man. There'd be no point in doing it. It wouldn't be realistic at all. But it's fun to fantasize, and every now and then when something really does turn out to be true, it just kind of makes those fantasies a bit more sweeter, don't you think?
Yeah. So we just had to believe the fact that when Fiona left the show in the late 90s, she was pregnant with Steve's baby.
I've heard you can be pregnant.
Didn't say or do anything about it. So yeah, it was not too difficult a pill to swallow, and it did.
The fact you said swill is such a Freudian slip.
And it did lead to some lovely Simon Gregson and Ali Mardell moments. Yeah, like I say, it's a shame that it just is over. But yeah. I mean, she may well come back to the show one day.
Tell me about Gordon and Betty, Michael.
Well, this is the original one, and this really did get people's goats when it happened. So Gordon Clegg was a character who first appeared on the show in 1968 when the Clegg family arrived in to run the shop. So you had Les Clegg, the alcoholic shop owner, Maggie Clegg, his long-suffering and beaten wife, and Gordon Clegg, their son. And Les didn't stay on the show for very long at all. He ended up going to a mental hospital or something. And
Maggie was sisters with Betty.
Yes, yes. Betty came in later.
Betty the barmaid. Lovely Betty we all love.
Yes. But it was found out in 1974, so 6 years after this, Granny Hopkins, who was a character who was part of the Hopkins clan that were taking over the shop, discovered Gordon's birth certificate stuck at the back of the drawer in the flat, and that said that Gordon's birth mother was actually Betty.
What?
So this was the first time that we'd had a story on Coronation Street where somebody was revealed to be an existing character's parent that we didn't realise about before. And in this case, Betty and Maggie had known about it all along. Gordon didn't. And there was a really emotional scene where Maggie reveals this to Gordon. But this was a big shift.
Secret child of a man, so much easier to pull off than secret child of a lady.
But it's okay because it all happened off screen many
Normally
years
ladies
before.
Know when they've had a baby. Not all the time. Say 99.9% of the time you know if you've had a baby, if you're a woman. So the fact that... And the thing is, though, this has happened like before where people have been raised by a woman, a family member who isn't actually the mum. Mm. And you know, there's lots of like famous examples like... Who's the guy that was in The Shining? I'm doing the knocking.
But here's Johnny Go, Jack
Nicholson. Jack Nicholson. And also, famously, the murderer, Ted Bundy. He was raised by his grandparents, I think, or his sister was his mum. There's lots of examples of this in real life. I think it was easier to get away with maybe back in the day when it was hush-hush if you were pregnant and you got shipped off somewhere to have the baby.
Now, although this was definitely believable and in no way a retcon, but more of a revision, it really didn't go down well with the actors involved at the time.
And I think we haven't mentioned this until this point, have we? That the actors have no input, really. I mean, maybe some influential people can nudge a story in a different direction if they really don't want to play it. But on the whole, actors have no control over their stories, no input. I mean, we mentioned recently that we went to the VIP event with Ryan Prescott and Mikey North. They talk about the fact that they don't have any input on storylines.
No.
So sometimes you'll see actors doing a scene where something is fundamental about their backstory has changed and they have to sell it.
Mm.
That's their job as actors. They have to believe what they're saying to sell the story. And on the whole, I mean, I can't think of a time when an actor has not sold it to me that they believe it's true. It doesn't always impact whether I think it's true, but I can't fault the performances of some of these actors who've been given really tough jobs.
Yeah, I've seen some people, particularly with this Toy Story at the moment, saying, well, you know, Georgia Taylor should have refused to do it. I can't believe she's going through with it. I don't believe she's had much choice. And I know I've seen some people saying, yeah, but, you know, Sean Wilson, he was supposed to be having a story where Martin was going to get involved with an underage girl and he stopped that. I think that's a very, very rare occasion when character can... Well, yeah, exactly.
Why would you... I mean, fair play to him. Okay, you're empowered to do whatever you want. But that's, you know, I don't necessarily think that's the solution in every example. Just quit the show.
Well, Bill Kenwright, who played Gordon Clegg, once said, they sent me the scripts, I read them, and I cried. And then I was shocked, really, really shocked, but not nearly as shocked as Irene. So that's Irene Sutcliffe, who played Maggie, because she was not only shocked, she was angry. Irene said that it demolished the effort that both actors had put into making their relationship believable, and the viewers didn't like this either. Loads of people sent in letters. It was really quite the scandal back then, because, yeah, they'd been asked to invest in this mother-son relationship between Maggie and Gordon. It's not Gordon's fault. He didn't realise that he wasn't actually Maggie's son, but everything that Maggie had put into it, saying, you're my son, I'm going to treat this, you know, this other character as if they're my son, it just was up the wall. It was...
No, nothing from Betty about what she thought, though.
No, I can't remember, but, I mean, I think at the end of the day, as in many of these cases, it did lead to an even more lovely, stronger relationship between the characters. Bill and Betty, although we didn't see a whole lot... Sorry, Gordon and Betty, although we didn't see a lot of Gordon Clegg after this. He made sporadic appearances, didn't he? You definitely bought the mother-son relationship between them. And off-screen, Gordon... Bill Kenwright and Betty Driver, who played Betty Turpin Williams, ended up having this lifelong off-screen mother and son kind of lovely sort of relationship. So it led to something nice.
And then another thing to add, like, imagine how... I mean, you don't have to imagine... Remember how betrayed you felt by the most awful retcon / revision that you've ever experienced on the show?
Mm.
And then imagine how you'd feel if you were an actor who had been playing that character based on the information that you had been given and then get told that this is now your reality and has been for many, many years.
Yeah.
Of course, you're going to be shaken, but on the whole... The characters on the actors on Coronation Street have risen to the challenge, because it is a challenge. It's really hard to act a story or a scene that you don't really believe is true to your character. And loads of these actors have lived with these characters for multiple years, sometimes decades worth of this character's backstory that lives in their heads, and then you get asked to reimagine your fictional history and then play it in a really sincere way that sells this retcon / revision to the audience. That's a big ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should acknowledge that and really appreciate the hard work and the sweat and the tears that goes into imagining some of these stories as they have been given.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to criticise. God knows we do it every week, but I want to just say a big thank you to all the actors who've been given tough sales like these.
Let's stick on the parentage theme, but if we kind of move on to times when the stories and backstories of characters have had to change, or just general plot points where we've had to think about them in a different way because later story writers decided that more suits my narrative.
On the whole... A lot of these stories are asking a main character to believe that they've been lied to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's easier to do because that feels like it doesn't betray all the work you've done to establish a character. Mm. So a good example recently is Tyrone's parentage. So we thought Jackie was Tyrone's mum. She appeared in the... was it Deirdre?
Yeah, she was in the Feed the Weatherfield Run story.
Exactly. So who knows who will appear in Roy's Free Roy Cropper story? Don't know. But she appeared as a cellmate of, or like a fellow felon of Deirdre's. We didn't realise that she was not Tyrone's mum the whole time she was in the show. She last appeared in 2009, and then her backstory was changed about 9 years later, so that Cassie gave birth to Tyrone. Evelyn left him in a police station doorstep, and Jackie took him in and raised him as her own. So this whole time, she's been acting like she's his mum, but Tyrone had no way of knowing. So it wasn't really a betrayal of his character that he was as shocked as the viewers were to discover this wasn't true.
Yeah, but it was a bit of a betrayal for Margie Clark, though, because she played Jackie Dobbs as genuinely as you could. That I'm your son. I've dragged you up. I sacrificed my life for you because they didn't have the best of relationships. At the end of the day, it's like, oh, actually, no, I just found you on a step.
You can sacrifice your life to a baby that you didn't
give
birth to. I mean, can I just point out to you that this is what many men do?
Yes, of course. But I think that it was definitely originally written that she was the birth mum. Yeah. And there plenty of opportunities could have arisen on the times when she and Tyrone were falling out for her to have said, you know what, I'm not even your real mum.
But does that not give her a bit more integrity as an adoptive mother to have never thrown that in his face? Because this is one of
the... But Jackie isn't the kind of character who has integrity, just adds to the retconniness of it.
I know, but this is one of the things about soaps, is that they do love to throw adoptive families under the bus in the pursuit of dramatic scenes.
I really, really love everything to do with Evelyn, and I'm so glad she's part of the show now. But why they couldn't have had Evelyn just be Jackie's mum, I don't know. Because I think when they brought Maureen Littman in the show, there was no idea then that they were going to bring Cassie into it 5 years down the line. And I'm enjoying Claire Sweeney on the show.
Claire Sweeney's been fantastic. But her and Maureen Littman are great as Cassie and Evelyn.
For my headcanon of how things worked out, I'd have preferred it if they'd have sidestepped what they've created here and just said, no, Evelyn is Tyrone's maternal grandmother, and then just run with it that way.
It's a retcon. It does irk me. I mean, it's not a retcon, it's a revision.
They're all revisions. I think they're all revisions apart from Jack Tilsley. Jack and Arthur Tilsley.
Sorry.
This is fine. I suppose we don't need to say whether they are or they aren't. It's just how much they bug us.
I think the thing is, the colloquial use of the word retcon doesn't really consider the difference between a revision and a retcon.
No.
And I'm perfectly happy for people... I just want to make this clear too. Perfectly happy for you to use them interchangeably, because God knows I do. But, because this is a very nerdy podcast, we're going to be more specific.
Do you want to say a bit about the next one?
So Billy's part in Susan's death, because we know Susan Barlow, who is Ken's...
Daughter. Yeah.
She died off screen in a car crash in 2001. So we know that happened. The character had been in the show for a little bit, but then she just dies.
Bringing in her unterminated son, Adam.
That's right. But in 2017, dear old sainted Billy Mayhew, now the Archdeacon of Weatherfield, confesses, because he thinks he's going to die.
He got stabbed in the leg, didn't he? Do you remember? By a little... it's like a pendant or something.
Don't say little.
It was significant
enough to cause almost fatal damage.
Stabbed him in a bad part.
He tells Peter that he had a rough past. Maybe he was hanging out with the wrong guys. He was in a getaway car, and they were escaping the scene of a crime, and they forced Susan's car off of the road, and he didn't realise, maybe, but now he's worked it out, that they were responsible for her death.
I can't remember at the time whether we were supposed to believe that Billy knew all along and had just been keeping quiet about it, or whether he'd found out about it since.
No, I can't remember either.
I've got a feeling it was the former, and that he's just not said anything, and this was his big confession, and he'd known all along. Which makes it worse, because he had many years where he could have said something, or even just looked a little bit guilty or shifty around the rest of the Barlow clan, but he didn't.
I've firmly established on the show that I'd love a good deathbed confession, but I also don't know how realistic they are. Like, when I'm dying, I'm not sure if I'm going to tell certain people that I thought their hairstyles were bad and that they have bad breath. But anyway, that's what Billy decided to do. He hadn't shown any shiftiness around Peter before this, but anyway.
Did that one bother you? Going back and recontextualising. And this was an off-screen event as well. We didn't see Susan's car crash at all. We saw her get in the car with Adam up in Scotland. And the next thing we know, I think it's Peter telling everyone in the pub that his sister's had a car crash and she's dead. So it was certainly nothing that we had to say. Oh, but when we saw it, there was nobody looking like Dan Brocklebank there.
No,
but I think
true.
The coincidence...
It's very coincidental. It was to facilitate his, Peter, punishing him, and then him going on drugs.
Yeah, well, led to the whole cliff drop story, didn't it, of that Christmas.
Now, as a revision goes, I don't feel like this was worth it because, I mean, we know your great aunt Valerie didn't like this. She sent us clippings in the Post to complain about Billy's taking drugs in the church. I don't feel like it added to a rich tapestry that makes Billy who he is today.
Well, it's also been kind of forgotten about since, hasn't it? Like, I don't feel that any of the Barlows bear any kind of grudge towards Billy whatsoever.
And Billy hasn't taken this, I mean, I know he was on drugs it was insinuated he was a druggie when he was younger.
Yeah.
And then he relapsed and started taking drugs again in the church. And you'd think that it might come up with Paul. Now he's facing his MND diagnosis and he has painkillers and he's talking about pain and drugs and medication and he's got these pills. None of it's tempting Billy. None of it's making him remember what it was like to be a drug addict. I'm not saying that everybody who is a drug addict would feel the same way, but I'm saying this is a soap, and so there's a kind of pattern that these characters follow that Billy isn't.
Yeah, I don't think it was really worth it. And again, this is very similar to the Toya storyline from this week, where they're taking a storyline that parts of it occurred off screen, and then they're saying this is what happened just when you weren't watching. And it's a bit of a stretch to believe it.
And if you are waiting for our verdict about what we think about Toy Story as far as retcons versus revisions and how plausible the action is, you're going to have to wait till Saturday's show. We will talk about
it. We'll talk about it more then, because we haven't even seen
we're not going to talk about it if we've actually seen most of the action.
Yeah, the confession between Toya and Nick. A couple of bigamies that have been somewhat retconish over the year. So we saw Beth
you
and
keep
Kirk...
You saying over the year, but you mean
over
years.
Over the years. Mm-hmm. We saw Beth and Kirk get married in 2015 in that 80s retro-inspired wedding.
Madonna.
But the very following year, Craig starts doing a bit of digging in and shows some interest in seeing his dad, Daryl. And then this is when Daryl reveals to Craig that I never got divorced from your mum. So then it turns out that Beth wasn't actually legally married to Kirk whatsoever. She was a bigamist. And that leads to Kirk splitting up with her for a bit. Craig distrusts her for a little while. I didn't get on with this. I refuse to believe that Beth would have just turned a blind eye to the fact that she was already married to Daryl. You can't just hope that a wedding goes away. And I know Beth's not supposed to be the brightest bulb, but she wouldn't have thought, no, it doesn't count, it's okay, I can hope I can get away with it. What about you? What do you think about that one?
I'm just trying to look up what are the rates of bigamy in this country. We're not going to talk about religious reasons why you might do this, but this is very specific because this is the first one I've got. In Leicester... In the year of 2021, how many cases of bigamy do you think there were?
3.
58.
What? Wow. So bigamy is a little bit more rampant than I might expect.
Bigamy's back and it's bigger than ever.
How did you find this whole story of Beth actually being married to someone else before she married Kirk?
I don't like bigamy storylines because I think they're silly. They're always based on like a technicality of law. It kind of like insinuates that the person who wants to get married has no regard whatsoever for the legal ramifications of marriage, but equally wants to get married again. Like, why would you? I don't understand why you would disregard something and then also really, really want to do it again.
She just loved her care. Okay. I didn't like it.
It just reminds me a little bit. Okay, right. This is what it reminds me of: the puppy farming story, where it's like you didn't check a box on a form and pay the council a certain amount of money, so therefore you're doing something illegal. Mm. Like, it's fine, it's not real, it's like, surely a marriage is like as real as you believe it to be between the couple.
Mm.
That's what I think. This is why I don't agree with the idea that only certain religions are allowed to legally get married in a religious ceremony in this country. I think we should broaden it to any religious ceremony is a legally binding marriage, you know?
I think it's
as real as you believe
ones.
It to be. A marriage is only as real as you think it is. I think anybody should be able to get married. I think you should be able to say, oh, I'm married, fill out a form and you're married. I don't agree with any red tape. I think it's a personal relationship between two people. I think it should be like that. And I think that all this kind of silly, like, you didn't remember to tell us that you weren't married to that...
I don't completely agree with you there, but we'll save that for another time.
Talk about it later.
But yeah, Beth and Kirk, I thought that was a real shame, and it had a bit of a short-term impact, but at the end of the day, it wasn't worth it.
But Beth and Kirk's relationship has been a series of, like, why are they making them mad at each other?
Yeah, and they're going to fall out
again. I thought that they were love's, you know, young dream, and now they're...
So you also had Tim, who it was revealed in 2019 that he was also married to somebody else when he married Sally. So he married air hostess Charlie Wood in 2004, apparently, when he went on a stag party in Las Vegas. And then he spent the next 15 years believing that it wasn't actually legally binding because it was just a Vegas wedding. And it wasn't until Jeff and Yasmin got married out there, which is still very weird to me.
Yeah, that's
that
weird.
It was brought to his attention that actually his marriage to Charlie was real and now he's a bigamist. I just thought it was silly. Again, the idea that Tim wouldn't believe that this marriage was real.
Well, he is stupid.
He is stupid. But I thought that was a bit too much of a stretch, and I kind of wish that that hadn't happened. Because again, what long-term consequences did it have? Not much. In fact, it meant that a married couple that were, you know, out of the current characters who are married, they were probably the longest married couple, and now it turns out that they weren't properly. So I don't like it when
I
they do that.
I hated it. I thought it was silly. Pointless. We had Sharif's affair with Sonia, so this is what facilitated his exit, and also Yasmin's, you know...
Yeah, we were supposed to believe that he'd been having an affair for 7 years off screen, and that was very much we didn't see it happening. We didn't not see it happening, but I thought that was really a big stretch of credulity when that was a...
And I don't know that we needed it, really, to get rid of Sharif.
No.
But, okay.
Yeah.
Don't like it.
Another big one... and again, this is a proper retcon. This just doesn't make sense. Is surrounding Annie Walker and her ownership of the Rovers. Because back in the 80s, or back up until the, I think it was the Duckworths took over in the 90s, the landlord or landlady of the pub didn't own it. They just had the tenancy. But when
this
Betty
was a
died,
major plot point of many stories in the early 60s, because there's a very different relationship between a tenant of the brewery looking after a pub. It's the same way that you rent a house.
Yeah.
They're not really the custodians of the property. They're just running a business that happens to be located in the pub. And there are loads of scenes about Annie wishing she could relocate to a different pub and, you know, having fantasies of a pub in Cheshire, etc., etc. But
despite all this, when Betty died in 2012, some of the other characters were looking around Betty's stuff and found a note supposedly written by Annie Walker you know, 30 years previously, saying that she bequeathed the Rovers to Betty, and so therefore, all of this time, the Rovers has belonged to Betty. Utter load of nonsense. And this was a few months before the podcast first started, so we didn't have any reaction to it on air back then. And I think even if we had been watching then, it wouldn't have bothered us quite so much because we didn't know as much about Corey history back then. But I know there are an awful lot of people that absolutely hated this, and this is kind of something that has been almost retconned out of existence, because this portrait that you got of Betty in the Rovers, Stella ended up was being the one to put it on the wall originally, and it had a little plaque underneath that said Betty Williams, landlady, 1984 to 2012, and now it doesn't even say that.
No.
So it was officially canonised that Betty was the actual real genuine landlady for all that time, and now the show's kind of stepped back from it and gone, no, maybe not. Let's not talk about that. That's utterly ridiculous. And I get that they're trying to do something that was a bit sentimental.
Yes.
And say, oh, Betty, she's the heart of the Rovers. And in many ways, she was for many, many, many years. She was the member of staff that worked there for the longest. But to turn things around and say, well, actually, technically, she was the landlady of it. And we weren't supposed to believe, or were we? I don't know whether we were supposed to believe that she knew about it and just didn't say anything about it, or didn't care, or did she not open the letter herself? I don't know. But
this is one of those things where it feels as though, as a soap, Coronation Street lacks a bit of courage, because they could have had a story where Betty was just the best the best barmaid there ever was. We could have had a story where Ashley and
Fred
were just really, really strongly like
uncle and nephew.
But they had to up the ante to try to add credibility to these relationships and situations, when they could have just relied on the fact we've seen Ashley and Fred be really strong and have a great relationship. Did we really need him to be his dad? Did we really need...
I still would say yes.
Did we really need Betty to secretly be the landlady this whole time? Does it not kind of... And like all these secret brothers and sisters and dads and mums, do we need to... Can Coronation Street not kind of like promote alternative ways of like being important in other people's lives? That's what kind of I get stuck on. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right, we've still got so much to go. Gemma, let's do a quick whistle-stop tour of characters whose names have changed over the year. I'm gonna pass this one over to you. So whose has had a bit of a different name over the year? And so is this revision, is this retcon, whatever?
Right.
People have said it. Have they seen it written down? Does that make it a retcon? It doesn't really matter, but go on.
Rob Donovan who? He was actually called Darren. Phil Collins said his middle name was Darren when he's...
Phil Collinson, not Phil Collins.
Phil Collins. He was like, hey.
Phil Collinson's the producer.
He said his middle name was Darren.
So, yeah, Rob was referred to before he came on screen. Carlos was always talking about her brother Darren.
This is what I said before about do people have middle names, but I don't know. Episode 222, Jed Stone says his names are Gerald Arthur. And then he previously establishes it as
John Edward Stone.
Annie Speedwell.
Yeah, lots of maiden names were changed, especially in the early days.
She was actually Beaumont.
Yeah, the Beaumont family, the Beaumonts of Clitheroe, were quite high society, but she was originally Annie Speedwell in the scripts.
We had Irma, she appeared before the Ogdens, the other Ogdens. She was called Irma Smedwick, but then she changed to Ogden. We had Sheila Cordingley, who was actually Sheila Birtles later. Doreen Binns, who turned to Doreen Lostock.
Yeah, because quite a few of the other ones. And we also, there was also a big, big, big name change was Rita. And there's a whole story of retcons and revisions for her story.
Yeah.
So she first appeared in 1964 as Rita Littlewood. Obviously, that was the name that she would later go on to keep as her maiden name. But then when they brought Barbara Knox back into the show in 1972, she was playing what was originally going to be an original character called Mrs. Bates.
So there was no relationship between these
two? No relationship between them whatsoever. It just happened so that they brought the same character, the same actor back in, because Rita's 1964 appearance was just once, and then it's like, well, let's give her a bigger part now. Yeah, exactly. So Mrs. Bates' son, Terry, had been a bit of a pain in the ass at school, and Ken had to visit his mum to discuss the issue with her. And so she went for a while being, oh, I'm Terry Bates' mum. Then it was decided, why don't we just make them the same character as the one that I played back
same
in 1964?
Actress,
so later on that year,
they re-established
her backstory with Dennis, and the character, this Mrs. Bates character, and the character was called Rita Littlewood again. And then it was decided that although she was Harry Bates's mum, she was actually just, she had the common law wife to his dad.
So she just called herself Mrs.
She
Bates
called herself Mrs.
Because
Bates.
She was in a serious relationship with the father
of this Terry, yeah. So that was very messy, just to facilitate the idea that this is the same character as I played before.
I think they liked Rita Littlewood more as a character than Mrs. Bates, but they really liked Barbara Knox.
Yeah.
So they were like, how can we keep Babs in it? Let's just make it the same person.
And I think they probably thought it's more interesting to have a character who's a lounge singer in.
Yes.
So let's make it her.
And also, obviously, it plays into her strengths as an actress and a performer, that she's better as a lounge singer than a mum.
Quite. So that's kind of there's probably copious examples that we won't go through, I haven't found, of names changing
over
the years.
But what about dates?
What about dates? Well, let me tell you. In December 1960, Annie Walker said her birthday was in June, but later on, she had a birthday in August.
Well, how about in 1961, Ina Sharples says she was the oldest resident of the street when she was aged around 70, but then later sources gave her date of birth as 1899, but Albert Tatlock was born in 1895 and Martha Longhurst was born in 1896.
So she wasn't the eldest at all.
What
shocking.
A liar.
Well, how about this one then? 14th of April, 1980, it's established that Ivy tells Vera that it's her and Jack's wedding anniversary on Friday, and that contradicts the Duckworth's established wedding date of the 19th of August, 1957.
Yeah.
So another April to August. How are we supposed to believe anything that these writers ever tell us?
Well, in episode 317, Annie Walker says that she and Jack Walker took over the tenancy of the Rovers' Return Inn on the 4th of February. But that contradicts the events in episode 1749, where 1937 is given as a date. It's like they make it up.
You didn't say
1939.
1937. It changed from 1939 to 1937. Two-year difference. Terrible, terrible. And also, so you'd think that in the olden days, definitely people weren't, there was no archivist back then. People thought nobody's going to remember. There's nobody to check with, whatever, it doesn't matter. But even some dates into the modern era weren't as tight as they should have been. And I remember when the Battersby's came into it, it was a bit unusual because earlier, Janice was the very first Battersby to arrive. She came in like early in 1997. The rest of the clan was in July. But when Janice came into it, she was credited as Janice Lee. But when they came into it, she was married to Les and had apparently been married for years. So she shouldn't have been Janice Lee. She should have been Janice Battersby.
Absolute tosh.
So what a load of rubber. Can we talk about soap opera rapid aging syndrome, which is, I think, something that is prevalent in lots of other soaps, particularly American and maybe Australian soaps, I'm going to say, where they take a character, a child character, and decide, oh, it's a bit boring them being young. Let's just age them up a little bit so that we can get them onto the raunchier stuff or the more interesting storylines and maybe get them, you know, on the books and having them in more stories so they don't have to worry about school a little bit sooner.
I can't be mad about this because I think many of the writers who were around in this era were in the period in which you would have lied about how old you were to go and fight the Nazis.
See, we talked just last week on the podcast about Ardy and Asher. This is the biggest one of the modern era, and it's stayed. So they were born. We saw them being born in 2006, but the current agreed canon is that they were born in 2005.
And that is an actual retcon.
This is a 100% proper retcon because we can see them popping out a senator in 2005, but now we're led to believe that it's 2006. The fact that that is a retcon, how does that bother you?
I don't care at all.
I think I don't care as much as I should. I think if I start to think about it a little bit too much, it irks me.
It's kind of annoying, but it's just so... I mean, it should be more annoying because it's a retcon instead of a revision, but it is so... I mean,
if it was the sort of thing that they were doing more often, yeah, that would really annoy me.
I mean, it should be more bothersome because it's an actual retcon for such a stupid thing, like to make them.
I think it was just to make them be closer in age to Amy.
It makes sense. And so that
they would have friends of a similar age.
But how important is it? Dunno.
Yeah. Well, there was a couple of other characters who's were aged up a little bit. Even Peter and Susan Barlow were, but then it was put back again. So they were born in 1965, but then in 1978 they were aged up because they wanted to have a story where Peter wanted to join the Navy, and by 1978 he wouldn't be quite old enough yet, so that they aged him up. But then by 1986 they were back to their original age again, and I think Peter's current age does still tie in with being born in 1965, so we just had a temporary change of birth date.
Do you think this is easier because in showbiz, who knows when you were born is really what you can get away with saying?
I don't think so. But I suppose Peter and Susan, although they are main-ish characters, especially Peter, they were off screen for so long, weren't they? They went to live in Scotland for a while and they just make the odd visit here and there, so I don't think people were tracking their ages quite so long. Whereas with the Allahan twins, we saw them for a good 4 years on screen being a particular age, and then they were just aged up by a year. That's going to stick a little bit more.
But isn't Peter the most significant earliest Coronation Street character we've seen born and grow?
Yeah, for sure. Which is why I'm glad that they've at least put him back to the original date now.
I mean, I know we always talk about Ken Barlow and we love William Roach and we hope he's around for many, many years from now. And Chris Gascoigne's obviously left as Peter and hopefully he might come back in the future. But really, Peter is maybe the stealth most significant other character.
Interesting theory.
I think I'm right.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter anyway. He's back to his normal age.
But that's a good thing to consider. Who would you consider to be the most important Coronation Street character if you disregard, and why would you, Ken Barlow?
And finally, we also had Mark Redman. So this was another one of Mike's children. So he was born in 1983. But then he kind of went away. His mum was Maggie Redman, who was a florist that Mike got involved with. But then when those characters came back in 1992, the storyliners wanted it so that Mark and Nick Tilsley, Nicky Platt, would be together at school together. So Mark was aged up a couple of years. And then he'd even appeared the previous year, played by another actor. And he was, you know, definitely eight then. But, you know, the next year he was 10. So... again, not as major a character, so maybe it doesn't matter as much, but it's the sort of thing, like I said, if there was going to happen again and again and again, that would bug me more.
But Michael, who would want to be older when you could be younger? Dennis Tanner was aged down by 4 years at some point. He said he was 22 in episodes 11 and 40, but then later on they established his date of birth as 1942, which made him 4 years younger than he appeared in the pilot. And Ken's year of birth was changed from 1937 to 1939 at some point, because Raquel referred to the 1970.
No, so it was...
She referred to the old one, 1993, and then at some point...
Originally, he was born in 1937. Then it became 1939, but then when it was referred to again in 1993 by Raquel, she used the 1937 date, so I think that was probably a bit of a blip there.
In episodes 869, Annie Walker and Emily Nugent look at a picture of the Queen. Queen Elizabeth II, it's been printed to celebrate her 43rd birthday, and Emily says, "Oh, the Queen's nearly 5 years older than I am, but her established birth year was 1929, so that's wrong."
Yeah, terrible. Okay, what about, here's some dead or alive next segment. So Florrie Lindley, who owned the corner shop at the beginning of the show. So the living status of her husband was changed a little bit over the course of the show. Although this one was explained in scripts, I suppose, but I thought it was kind of interesting. So in episode 312, in 1963, Florrie says that her husband died years ago. And I don't remember even before that, there might have been other references to the fact that she was a widow. But in 1965, he turned up on the street for a 10-episode story. So back from the dead, Florrie Linley's husband. It was said that he was working as an engineer in India. He came back to reconcile with her, and everyone was quite surprised because she claimed to be a widow for all this time. So I think that's why it's not really a retcon or a revision, because all of the characters on the street were acknowledged the fact, hang on a minute, you've said he was dead.
Yeah, and she that was, makes
and
sense.
And she was just like, oh, yeah, I just
sorry, I lied.
I just been lying to you. It just, again, I don't necessarily like that idea. It wasn't originally supposed to be that he was in
A woman who owns her own business in that period of time would have had to have had a reason why her husband was not in charge of everything.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
In episode 25 of the show, Ivan Chevesky says to Annie Walker that a jumper that he's wearing was sent from Poland by his mum, but that then contradicted the later established fact that she committed suicide when Ivan was a teenager. So how did she send that jumper then? Hmm? Corey?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm? Ken's grandma Nancy, who was an early battle axe of Coronation Street back in the early 60s, yeah. She said that she'd been a widow for 4 years, but it was later established that her husband George was killed in action in the war in 1916.
The first war.
What a liar.
First World War, not even the second one.
And then you can't talk about characters, are they alive or dead or what, without mentioning Mary's mum.
No.
Who's possibly one of the most spoken about but never seen characters on Coronation Street. And I don't know whether the show can decide or not whether Mary's mum is alive or not.
We've spoken before about whether we think she should appear as a character.
Well, we saw Mary and Norris go off to her mum's funeral back in, 2008, 2009, I think it was. But then after that, she said, oh, actually, my mum's alive. And it was established by other characters other than Mary, I think, that Mary's mum was actually alive. So are we supposed to forget that this funeral existed?
Well, Norris was dead now, so dead men tell no tales.
Well, exactly, but Norris went to the funeral of somebody who was later established to be alive. That really doesn't make
Helen
sense.
Helen Nugent says, the archivist we mentioned previously, she's probably just trying to get attention. She's a fantasist, and that's definitely true.
I don't know whether that quite fits for Norris, though. A few other little details, we're just bam, bam, banging through all of these now. In episode 16, Ina was said to not be a member of the Glad Tidings Mission Hall.
Lies.
But she was. In 1903, the episode that is, not the year, Audrey describes Gail's father as a gambler who made a promise of marriage that he didn't live up to. And she says that they lived with his parents. That was completely thrown out of the window when Ted came up on the scene later on. In episode 569, Annie says that Lucille Hewitt has got 6 A-O levels. But then earlier on, she only had 5.
Maybe she got another one.
Maybe. Even though Ken said that he visited Denise and Daniel in 2011, that was supposed to be when Daniel was raising himself.
Yeah, remember that's that? a bit of
his backstory. Yeah. It's like Ken seemed to go off to visit family members, but forget who was what and happened. Wasn't there, because he visited Susan all this time.
I
and
think
Adam
he just goes
wasn't there, and
he just goes and gets completely drunk and blacks out and doesn't know what happened.
Wouldn't surprise me. When Ray Langton came into the show for the final time in 2005, after leaving for Holland in the late 70s, he said, I've been in Holland all that time, but if you watch the Corey spin-off video, Viva Las Vegas, you'll see that he was actually there. He was working over in Vegas, wasn't he?
Wasn't in Holland at all.
No. And who can forget the time in 2015 when Kevin Webster said, I couldn't possibly imagine what it was like to have lost a child, even though he had done himself. Even though poor little, what was he, Jake Webster died at birth. The following year acknowledged to be a script error. And Kevin, I think, mentions in a script in the following year, oh yeah, I did have a son who died.
That's definitely different. A script error is a bit different from a retcon and a revision, because it's just a mistake that maybe a certain wording evokes a meaning that you had not meant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I didn't mind too much about that, but I remember the internet getting quite het up about the whole thing. And finally, and this
doesn't count. Probably what everyone's been waiting for, isn't it?
What, fake Katie? Mention.
Yeah, fakey. This was Jim's...
This was teased as a retcon or revision, but then turned out that it wasn't one at all.
So Jim and Liz had a baby that was stillborn.
No. She died a few days after.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Very, very sad. That was the making of the McDonald's. This was how they managed to worm their way into the hearts of the viewers, because they weren't a very popular family before this, but Liz did such a great job of making everyone empathise with her that it really put everyone on their side. But it turns out that Jim decided to use this against his ex-wife when he got Hannah, the evil Australian, to pretend to be Katie, who was the dead child.
Swapped at birth.
So we
grew up in Australia.
Initially believed that this was a retcon and that Katie hadn't died and that Jim had somehow found her in later years. But it turns out that Jim and Hannah were just pretending that she was
Big
Katie.
Old scam.
And they were dating each other, and it was all just a way to extort money from Liz. And
still not the best of stories.
It's not a great story, but this is an example of why spoilers and knowing about what the story is,
what you think it's going to be,
might not necessarily give you the full picture of what will actually happen, and maybe you should reserve judgment on some things. This is why we don't like doing spoilers on the show, because it doesn't always really. There's lots of misdirection. There's lots of spoilers and false information and half-heard plot lines by people that shouldn't really be.
I can already think of times when I've ranted about things that I think are going to happen, then it turns out that it doesn't. I know I said that was the end, but I also wanted to ask: do you think that?
To me.
Yeah, yeah. When sets change.
Oh,
is
that
a retcon? I mean, the Rovers, we've spoken about many times before, has expanded and shrunk numerous times over the years. Just recently, the kitchen in the Rovers became much, much grander than how we'd seen it for the many years before then, although I think still not quite as big as it had been in the early 90s when they had the tarantula story in there. Is that a type
that
of
retcon? That is actually a retcon. Because that is a retcon.
You see it on screen one way and then later
yes,
on,
it
it's a different way. The fact that the Snug used to be this massive function room off the side of the
Select.
Rovers. Massive function room off the side of the Rovers. They have a fire in the mid-80s and now it's not there, but there's no space where it could have existed. And even, if you think
like
about
the
layout.
It goes into Ken's house.
Yeah, yeah. But even the layout of the pub from the front, if you stand outside the pub, there's no way that room could have ever fit in there. Even now, there's no way that the kitchen or the back room of the Rovers could fit into the shell of the what's it called? The land.
Yeah, the geographical. There's far more geographical retcons than there are, just the existence of Rosamond Street and where that is.
Oh, yeah, the fact that for many years, Rosamond Street was one of the main thoroughfares of Weatherfield, and you
and
could see, looking under the arch, how it stretched off into the distance, and now it's nothing.
You could walk it in a minute,
30
seconds.
And there's somehow like a 19 Rosamond Street, even though there's only about three other addresses that are there.
And also, how do cars get fast enough down Rosamond Street to knock people over and kill them? Doesn't make any sense. How do people physically fit into most of these houses? Where are the bedrooms and the beds?
I think we're stretching what counts as a retcon or a revision,
Those are more retcons than anything else, because we've seen with our eyes, we know that Sean was living in the same house as Dylan and Eileen and George and Todd, but these are supposedly two, maximum three bedroom terraced houses. Makes no sense.
Lots about Corrie doesn't make sense, but sometimes you just have to
roll with it.
Oh well, let's go along with it and enjoy the ride, and hopefully we'll get some cracking performances from the actors who can convince us that it was like this all along.
Yes.
I'm really glad that Corrie's not like some of those soaps across the seas who are happy to retcon willy-nilly just to serve the purpose of the plot. On the whole, you know, Corrie's been going 63, 64 years, and the kind of things that we've been talking about this evening are so, so rare.
The fact
and
that there
sometimes
are also
you just have to say, whatever. Okay.
Very few actual retcons that you can say that I saw that didn't happen.
Yeah.
There are loads of revisions that kind of like you feel like, nah, I'm not really sure that was true.
It's like, I wouldn't believe that is true. And that's still just the perfectly valid feeling to have.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I don't believe that would really have happened.
Yeah,
there's certainly many things where I think that about.
Yeah, but absolutely.
In the grand scheme of things, I can't think of a time when it has completely ruined a character or made a character not important, or even if at the time it's felt really, really irritating when they've done that. I know I was definitely fuming at the idea that Jackie has been cut out of Tyrone's life, but looking back on it now, I'm like, okay.
Well, you know, it's in the passing, time softens all ills, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's not like Corrie in British soaps is the only one that does it as well. I mean, I've not looked into retcons in Emmerdale, retcons in EastEnders, but I know that they do exist.
Yeah.
They absolutely exist, but now is not the time for
that. So, what do you think? Write in. Have you got any things that really stuck in your craw? Do you disagree with my hard line on what is a retcon versus a revision? Do you think that they're justified? Are there any that you are fine with and not? Let us know. Email us conversationstreet@gmail.com, or otherwise just wait for our episode on Saturday where we might be talking about another one.
Maybe. God, I don't know how that's going to go. Right, thank you everybody for listening.
Yes,
and we will
you.
See you at the weekend. Ta-ra.
Bye.
The music for this episode came from podcastthemes.com.